Paul Theroux visited our show 10 years ago to talk about a trip he'd made from Cairo to Cape Town, traveling south along the eastern side of the African continent, and about Dark Star Safari, the book that he'd written about that trip. So when Mr. Theroux decided at the age of 70 to return to Cape Town and resume his journey, traveling north this time along the west side of Africa and finishing it in Timbuktu, we knew that we would have to invite him back. His account of his latest trip, The Last Train to Zona Verde, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased that it brings Paul Theroux back to our show today. Hi.
Hi. It's great to see you again.
And it's interesting to think about the reasons you've been here over the years. We haven't talked about every one of your novels, but by my account, you have written 29 novels and about 16 to 17 travel books.
Yeah. I published a novel last year, The Lower River, set in Africa. And I didn't go on a book tour, but I was very enthusiastic about the novel because it was about a man that goes back to Africa, goes back to his Peace Corps school, and is sort of held captive in the place. And
I'm sure inspired by some of the experiences you were
captured.
Actually,
inspired by something that happened to me in the 60s. Anyway, it's called The Lower River, very dear to my heart. And this book, Last Train to Zona Verde, I went from Cape Town, resuming my Dark Star Safari trip, and headed north.
But you didn't make it all the way to Timbuktu. How long did it last, and how much of the projected journey did you actually make?
I didn't know how far I was going to go. I had a general direction north. I thought it would be great if I got to the Congo, Nigeria, Mali. But there was trouble in the Congo. Serious trouble. There were riots in Kinshasa. Nigeria is a no-go area. That's not a good place to go.
Even along the coast, because most of the trouble in Nigeria is in the north, and the south, where the capital is and where the former Biafra is, it seems to be relatively peaceful.
It's not peaceful. The delta, which is on the
oil
coast,
part,
is not where the oil is not. There are kidnappings and beheadings there, and in the north, I'd have to go through the north to where the Boko Haram fanatical fundamentalists are, and they are stirring up serious trouble. And the same thing in Mali. I mean, just different group, same motive, jihadists. So it's not something, someone can write about it, not me.
Well, you could have flown over those countries.
Yeah, I'm not a plane guy. I'm an overland. When I get to the end of the road, I stop. When someone says, oh, you can fly there, like Cabinda or the Congo, because I was kind of at a dead end in the north of Angola, and I was told, you can fly there. I said, that if I fly, I won't see anything. Flying into Angola, if you flew from New York to Luanda, which is the capital of Angola, you might have a pretty good time. If you go overland through the south, you have a very, very interesting, pretty awful, but very, very enlightening time.
Well, in his Wall Street Journal review of your book, Rian Milan wrote, it was almost insane to contemplate the journey that you'd planned at the age of 70. And you complain a bit about your age at various points in the book. Would you or could you have finished this trip if you'd been 40 years younger or even 20 years younger?
Well, you're still unarmed. If I'm, let's say I was 40 years younger and unarmed and still visibly a foreigner, it wouldn't have been very easy.
You would have, as you say here, still felt like easy prey?
Yeah. It's not a question of age. It's not a question of age. The road still has a lot of potholes. You're still going to be on a bus. As a matter of fact, I think it's harder for a younger person, a younger, impatient, a millennial, used to kind of getting things on demand, is not going to sit not going to take 10-hour bus rides. Well, they're going to sit in their mother's basement and Google it. I think that I was kind of trained to take the rigors of the road. I don't think other people are.
Didn't this trip also give you a new sympathy for women traveling alone?
Oh, I have great sympathy and empathy for any woman traveler. A woman traveler is visible and constantly hassled. Africa's tough. India's tough. Pakistan. Turkey's tough. China's probably okay. Vietnam might be okay, but most countries, I mean, it's so hard to be a woman traveler. The Irish writer Dervla Murphy went through Ethiopia on a mule and was asked once, how did you do it as a woman? She said, I went as a man. She dressed as a man. You can do it that way.
Did you feel that to continue the trip into Nigeria and Mali would have been a daredevil effort and somewhat pointless at the same time?
Yeah, all daredevil. All these sort of a feat, a stunt, the feat of travel. That's not what travel writing should be about. Well, it's like a high wire act.
But you're also hoping to learn things about the people along the way.
Yeah, yeah.
And in this case, you just feel that the people are a little too dangerous. You wrote that by the end, you'd grown to hate this trip. And you say you were afraid that if you died before you got home, which seemed likely a couple of times, that people would mistakenly think that you died doing something that you loved.
Yes, because three people I met on the trip died, two violently and one with a heart attack. And what people kept saying about them, well, he died doing what he loved. And so when you're a traveler, you think, am I doing what I love? Am I really where I want to be? Well, and I was, but a lot of the time I was where I wanted to be, but not loving it.
Well, why was this all that different from your previous experiences in Africa? Is it just that it's West Africa?
No, because it's one thing after another. I think that the problem is the urbanization of Africa. I'm not programmed to go from one hellhole to another if it's an urban hellhole. I don't mind traveling through awful parts of the bush, but to go from one big sprawling urban nightmare to another, say from Luanda to Kinshasa to Lagos to, you know, I don't know, Kaduna, it's, you know, Africa is now 80 or 90% urbanized. These cities, to do that, you need to be a proctologist, or it's the proctology of travel. You're just going up someone's entrails.
And you say you found the African cities indistinguishable from one another in their squalor and decrepitude. Cape Town as well? You'd been to Cape Town 10
years
before.
No, Cape Town has a claim to being an outstandingly beautiful city, surrounded by slums or townships, but that's the trouble with the big sprawling city. But you could say the same about Kunming, Shanghai, Delhi.
Well, you've said you're not a big fan of cities in general.
No, I'm not.
I'm wondering if you're enjoying your stay here in New York.
I love being in New York, but New York is also unknowable. To write a book about New York would be an extremely difficult thing. I mentioned in the book that cities have an incapacity to be known. So you can go and you can sort of invent the city. That's what people do. They come and they're right up Madison Avenue or Broadway or Brooklyn or the Bronx, but they invent the contours of the city, then they write about it as though that's the city. But it's obviously not.
My guest is Paul Theroux, whose latest book is The Last Train to Zona Verde, My Ultimate African Safari. You open with a description of the time you spent with the Jukwasi people in Namibia. Was that your favorite part of the trip?
I had a lot of favorite parts of the trip. I had always wanted to meet these people who are the desert nomads, the hunter-gatherers, whose ancestry goes back 35 or 40,000 years.
And they're a subgroup of the Kung San.
You pronounced that correctly, the Kung San, written about by the Marshalls, by Lorna Marshall and Elizabeth Thomas Marshall, and by a lot of anthropologists.
Yeah,
How did you know that's the way that's pronounced?
I've heard it pronounced in the past.
Okay, you actually got a click. I think that's a point for Leonard Lope. But that you can... actually, there's a great book about them by... Wilhelm Bleek. Bleek and Lloyd wrote a book about the Bushmen. So I'd wanted to visit these people and see if they're the original people.
Well, how much of their original culture have they been able to maintain? You say real people. That's what their name means, yeah. Isn't it? The Jukwasi?
Yeah. How much of very little of their original culture, because they've been subverted by first by missionaries, by their own government, by other people, by the Herero tribe. And they were nomadic. They were moving around. They had a territory. Now they're sort of stuck in festering little outposts in the desert.
Is it similar to what happened to Native Americans?
Very much so. Very much so. And I say that as a part Native American. My grandmother on my father's side was Native American, and they were similarly subverted. They were rooked, they were exploited, and their land was taken away. And that's why I can identify, I mean, to that extent, with them. But the Juhasi, and I think you could say Native Americans and a lot of other Native peoples have their family intact. A lot of their values are intact. They may not be killing buffalo, or in the case of the Juhasi, they're not spearing lions, but they have their values. And you know, originally the first people on Earth looked after each other. They weren't necessarily warriors. There was sort of self-help, mutual aid, and I think you noticed that in Africa. But Africa is changing. I first went to Africa 50 years ago, 1963. I joined the Peace Corps. So for 50 years, I've been watching Africa change and writing about it.
Well, you talked about long bus rides. Are there trains? At one point on this trip, you ride on the back of an elephant.
Yeah, I was on the back of an elephant in Botswana. Yeah, that was interesting.
Was that just to have that experience, or was it the only way to get from one place to another?
No, that's a safari. The people who ride elephants and go on safaris are people from New York and Chicago. They're not people from Africa. Africans don't go on safaris. Africans in many cases don't even see animals. In Angola, where there are 2 million landmines planted, there are no wild animals. You don't see any elephants in Angola. You don't see a giraffe. You don't see any animals. You don't see any tourists either. So I wanted to go on a safari just to. For that experience. That's a very rarefied experience.
Has Angola finally stabilized its political system?
They have a long...
I mean, that was a country that was really caught up in the Cold War.
Very much so. Very much so. The Cuban forces were on one side and the South Africans supported the other side. They've had the same government for 34 years, a man called Dos Santos. They would like him to have a soft landing and go away. Is it stable? It's stable in the way, I suppose, that any dictatorship is stable. You know, people love to travel in dictatorships because the thumb is on everyone's head. You can travel around there. There are roadblocks. It's a bribing and it's a corrupt government. I think it's a corrupt society.
And that's why there's that much tourism, you say?
There's no tourism because there's nothing to see there. I mean, the people who go there are oil people, diamond people, gold people. So the hotels are extremely expensive and very, very bad.
There's a very funny chapter in the book describing an ill-fated taxi ride that you took while you were in Angola. Some of our listeners may recognize the story because it was excerpted in the New York Times. Your driver got drunk and the car broke down, leaving you stranded in what felt like the middle of nowhere and you had nothing to eat?
Yeah. A little bit of it, the New York Times. When you say taxi, Leonard, I'm sure the listeners are thinking, oh, it's a yellow car with a meter running and a flashing light on top. It was not that. It was just an old wreck with eight people in it. Taxi only in the broadest sense.
Eight people? How do you fit eight people in a car?
You cram them in. You cram them. It was a Toyota Land Cruiser, old thing, and it died, and we were in the bush, and there was nothing to do and nothing to eat, and then an old woman came. That's the story. An old woman came through the dusk with a bucket and a pair of tongs. I looked at the bucket, and she said, "Frango." Chicken. And then I looked in, there were three pieces of chicken with flies on them. She said, "Qual? Which one do you want?" Which fly blown? And I sent her away. But then I eventually ate a piece of chicken. You know, thereby hangs a tale. But actually, in
flies
that.
Flies you can hardly taste.
I just built a fire and killed the germs. But in that town, there was a ceremony, a nubility ceremony, and of girls being initiated into womanhood. Nubility, of course, means marriageable. So they were becoming nubile, marriageable. And so it was a horrible place, and the food was awful, and the taxi broke, or the car broke down. But I witnessed this wonderful ceremony.
And you did finally wind up getting the car moving, and here you are. In the book and on other occasions, you've been critical of international aid efforts in Africa, and stars like Bono and Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, who made helping Africa their cause. From what you've seen, how has that aid hurt Africa? And you have very little time to give an answer.
All you can say is it hasn't done a lot of harm. But
are there better ways?
Yeah, by having a good government. By simply...
Well, how do you get Angola to have a good government? You can't impose it.
No, but you can't enable it either. I mean, you can't... If Bill Gates wants to run the health service in a lot of African countries, and the people in those governments, which are tyrannies in most cases, in Malawi and... well, not Malawi now, but as it was before, Zimbabwe and many other countries, they're thieves and corrupt. And Gates goes in and says, oh, you're not doing it very good with your health. We'll do it for you. You can go... you with your shopaholic wife, and you have the morals of a fruit fly. We'll run your health service for you. And so who gets?
So Mugabe doesn't have to worry about taking care of that.
Doesn't have to worry. So I don't despise what they do, but there are other ways of doing it.
Are you going to be?
And
doing...
by the way, there's no the only free cheese is in a mousetrap.
Are you going to be doing more traveling? Obviously not in Africa.
Yes. I ended the book talking about the American South. I've been traveling in Alabama, Mississippi, South Carolina.
Could you pick up from where you left off and start in Timbuktu and move north?
Do you know that's no one's asked me that, but if the Congo if it just gets a little quieter in Nigeria and Mali, yeah, I'd probably go back. So and I've, as I say, for 50 years, I've gone back. I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I've got the heart and soul of a Peace Corps volunteer. In other words, still curious and, after all these years.
You speak any Swahili?
I speak Swahili. Ndiyo, yeah. Abarigani, Mzuri, Mzuri, Wapi.
You got Bukati. Me. I don't speak Swahili.
Haraka, haraka, haina baraka.
I'm happy that I can say Kong. Paul Theroux has written many travel books, including Ghost Train to the Eastern Star, Dark Star Safari, and The Great Railway Bazaar, and 29 novels. The book we've been discussing is The Last Train to Zona Verde, My Ultimate African Safari. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.